Welcome, welcome, welcome back to the Bob Lefsetz podcast. My guest today is Slava Rubin, one of the co-founders of Indiegogo and chairman of the new platform, Vincent. Slava, good to have you here.
Thank you for having me. Very excited to be here.
Okay. Explain what Vincent is.
Vincent is an aggregator for alternative investments. Alternative investments are growing very rapidly. Alternative investments are anything that are not public equities or bonds. So you could think about it like collectibles, real estate, venture, crypto assets, art. All these things are growing rapidly, and there's not really a central place where the individual investor can try to look across all of their options. So that is Vincent. One place to start thinking about how to invest into alternatives.
Okay. Needless to say, we had Robinhood, and as a result of that, we had volatility in AMC. We had volatility in GameStop. Is this an arena where the average person should be playing?
Absolutely. So for the longest time, people felt that only the rich, the accredited investors, the family offices, the institutions were able to have access to these alternative investments. And they've known that being able to have a small portion of your portfolio across some of these riskier assets gave them higher returns overall. So today, you see about 5% of portfolios across investors in these alternatives. And too many people don't have anything in alternatives. And I really do believe that the average person should have somewhere between 5 to 15% in alternatives. You shouldn't bet the farm on it. You shouldn't put all of your savings in it. But a small portion of higher risk, higher return assets could give you a much better return overall.
Okay. Most people are financially unsophisticated. Those with some assets might have a financial advisor who would balance their portfolio, as you're saying. But we find, certainly on Robinhood, that it's a lot of people who are relatively young with some extra cash, and this might be their only investment. They might have an IRA. What do you say to those people?
So it's really just a function of a percentage of how much you have. So if you have $10 million, you should put, you know, let's call it $1 million, 10% into alternatives. If you have $1,000, you should think about putting $100 into our alternatives. It's really about putting that 5 to 10% into alternatives. Now, the question that I ask is, how do I only put, you know, $50, $500, $5,000 into alternatives? That's the beauty of what's happening in the last decade. Since about 2010, you've seen the dawn of all these alternative investment platforms across these individual asset classes. You have real estate platforms, you have venture platforms, you have art platforms, you have collectible platforms. And when I say collectibles, I'm talking about wine, I'm talking about cars, I'm talking about trading cards. You have crypto platforms, and they're all offering these fractional ownership where you can get a piece of the asset. You don't have to spend the entire $7 million on a Monet. Maybe you can spend $2,500 to get a piece. You don't need to spend the entire $400,000 for some Will Chamberlain card. You can buy a $10 piece. And that's the beauty of what's happening across all of these alternative investments. And it's becoming much more approachable for the everyday investor. Whether you have $10,000 of extra income to, $10,000 of worth that you can deploy, or if you have, $5 million, really you just can prioritize it accordingly as to how you would diversify.
Okay, let's assume I'm interested. How do I decide what to invest in? Am I purely, you know, flying blind, doing my own research? Are there any primers, anything that could help me out?
Yeah. So right now, the two places where you can really start as the investor to think about your alternative investment options is either you ask your buddy, you know, Sally or Sam that you talk to at work or on Zoom or at the golf course. And, you know, that person is going to be limited by what they know and what they have access to. Or you go onto Google and you try to do your research, which the research is complicated because most of the research and most of the information is coming often from the people trying to sell you the actual product. So it's hard to find objective information to try to research and diligence across all of your options. And that's exactly what Vincent, the platform which we launched 5 months ago with Vincent.com, is to be able to start your journey on alternatives with Vincent, which is, this is where you discover your options. This is where you do your diligence. This is where you can compare and contrast. And then you click through to the deals that you like and move forward.
Okay. If one examines the site, there's certainly hundreds of alternatives available. How much information is there? How does someone digest that information to help them make a choice?
Yeah, so there are dozens of different types of alternatives. We've grouped it into a simple taxonomy of six different options, high level. So do you want a debt alternative? Do you want a real estate alternative? Do you want a venture, which is like, you know, equity or venture fund, etc.? Do you want art? Do you want crypto? Or do you want collectibles? Everything will fall into the one of those six categories. Inside of that, you can then refine your filter in terms of how much you're trying to spend, what kind of returns you're looking for. And then we help you to try to navigate, compare, and contrast. Now, a real estate investment will have some similarities to a trading card investment, but there'll also be differences, which is part of the challenges of navigating across assets, but is also the beauty of the product that we've tried to create that simplicity for the comparison. Just to give you a really interesting stat, like I mentioned, we've been around now for 5 months. We have over 60 platforms already signed up on the supply side.
Wait. Just define what those platforms are, please.
So a platform is one of those originators. An originator is an organization that is SEC approved, and they are approved to be able to source deals in that vertical on behalf of the potential investors that would invest into that. So let's be specific. There's a platform called Collectible, which focuses on trading cards. They're SEC approved to be able to get, let's call it a Will Chamberlain card. Or yesterday, I invested in the Sandy Koufax card. They were able to get that card. They originated. They sourced that deal. They originated that offering. And Sandy Koufax, what I think, was selling. It's a PSA 9. PSA is a grading in the card industry. It's a PSA 9. I think there's like 36 of them in the world that are known. I think there's three PSA 10s. So this was a PSA 9 selling for like about $450,000. So if somebody's rich enough on the call, you know, listening, they could just try to go buy the whole thing. But what this platform is doing is making it more accessible by selling the shares at $10 a piece. And that is an originator. So Collectible is just one example of an originator.
So the originator establishes the price of $450,000. Theoretically, could I invest my $10? And since there's so much demand, the originator might say, well, now the value is $600,000.
No, it's just like an IPO. So when the IPO happens, that's it. It's happened. And then it goes into a secondary market. So when the IPO happens, that's the primary issuance. So the primary issuance is the first price that it goes to market with, and it's kind of like the IPO of this offering. So Sandy Koufax went for about $450,000. I bought my shares, you know, I put in $1,000, and you know, next week or next month, somebody might want to buy my shares for $12, or they might only be worth $8. And so I'll probably hold, because I believe Sandy Koufax is going to be worth a lot in the future. So I'll get to decide if I want to sell for $12 and get a 20% profit on my $10 shares, or if I'll hold. And that's just in the collectible space.
You mentioned a couple of things, and we have, let's say I'm investing. Does Vincent charge me to invest?
So Vincent does not charge the investor anything. We are on the side of the investor. We're helping them to discover and diligence. And we are just leading you to all of your options. We do not charge the investor anything, totally free.
Okay, so then how does Vincent get paid?
So Vincent is working with the originators to help them to be able to get more investors. So we're really like Google, which is a search engine, trying to, you know, get more qualified leads to our originators.
Okay, so let's say...
Sorry, you could just think of us as just a very vertical specific search engine like Google, but specifically for alternative investments.
Okay, now Google, they with AdSense, depending on what your ad is in bidding, you might pay more or less. So with Vincent, is every originated product a different deal, or is there a straight deal, or it's different every... company has a certain percentage that you charge them?
Yeah. So all the right now on Vincent, We don't actually have a paid promotion product like AdSense. So when you search on Google for, you know, hotels in Cancun, there's the few people that are paying for those positions. And there's a few people, a few companies that are getting those positions organically because they deserve those top positions. Right now, we only have organic results. No one is able to pay to get better results in front of the investor on Vincent. We're only 5 months old.
Would you anticipate you might charge for that visibility?
That very well might happen. You know, already our originators are asking us to get more visibility and more exposure and trying to pay us for that opportunity. But we're also trying to make sure we are serving the investor as well as possible in terms of having a trusted experience while trying to have, you know, a business that can be sustainable into the future.
Okay. So the Sandy Koufax card, the originator, how much are you charging the originator when someone buys on your platform?
Well, they don't buy on my platform, right? We hand off the investor to their platform.
Right.
So we don't charge anybody anything, meaning any investor anything. What the platforms charge is their different fee schedules. And one of the beautiful things that Vincent is able to do is transparently compare and contrast those fee schedules, because sometimes it's a little opaque because not all companies charge the exact same way. So it's a little hard to compare. We try to surface that to the front so the investor can understand what they're getting into a little bit better.
Okay, what might be the options of charging the ultimate investor?
I mean, it gets a little complicated. I mean, the originators decide their own way. Sometimes they'll just mark up the asset. So the asset might be worth, let's call it $100,000, but they'll sell it for $110,000. So they automatically made a 10% VIG without you really knowing it, even though you know it's built into the price. Sometimes they'll tell you, hey, we're only charging $100,000, but we're going to charge you 5% to do the transaction. Sometimes it's all just baked in. They might offer it for free, meaning at price, at market, for the $100,000, because then they want to make money on the secondary trades when you're trading from $10 to $8 or from $10 to $12 in that secondary market. Maybe they want to be able to charge you some money on each of those secondary trades. So there's a lot of different ways. Maybe they want to get you into a subscription product. Maybe they want to get you into an AUM product. AUM.
Whoa, a little bit slower. What is a subscription and what is an AUM?
Well, subscription would mean maybe they want to get you into a more premier access of the way you work with their platform. So they charge you, you know, $10 a month or $100 a month or $1,000 a month to be able to get special privileges or deal flow or access or data. While others might be trying to get you into an AUM product, means assets under management. So they're trying to offer you a professional fund where instead of you picking specific stocks, and I say that as a metaphor, meaning individual assets, you might just say, I want to deploy money into this platform and just let them put all of their various individual assets into that fund. And I just want to invest into the fund. So all these origination platforms, which I mentioned we have well over 50 already, they all have their own business models. They have their own monetization models. They focus on their own verticals in terms of the assets they focus on. This is all very confusing often if you're just trying to navigate from the perspective of, I have an extra $10,000, what should I do with it? It's daunting. If you're just thinking, I have $10,000, what should I do with it? It's hard to know where to start. Because if you start in any one of those platforms, you right away go down the tunnel with that specific asset, with that specific platform. While with Vincent, we're trying to give you a very top-down view across the entire industry of all the assets and try to give you a compare and contrast across all the platforms within an asset or compare across assets. So yeah, the idea is to start your alternative journey with Vincent.
Okay, so you provide the lead, so to speak. How does Vincent get paid presently?
So we haven't been focusing very much on monetization since we're so young. But presently what's happening is platforms are partnering with us and then paying us on a per lead.
Okay, so let's just assume I buy my piece of the Sandy Koufax card. Let's just say the value is $100,000 to make the numbers easier to comprehend. What happens if they only sell $50,000 to investors?
So the originator, each originator has their own approach to that. But usually what they're doing is they're underwriting the card. So they've already kind of bought the entire card. So they already own the entire card. So anybody who's buying a piece doesn't have to worry about whether or not the entire card is sold, because as long as they have their piece, that's fine. Often they are trying to sell a specific amount. For simplicity's sake, let's say 50%. So let's say they're trying to sell 50% of Sandy Koufax. If they're only selling so far 40%, that doesn't mean that they have to wait for the other 10% to be sold, because the card is already in their ownership. They already custody the card, right? So it's not as if you have to try to get to that full number to try to own the card, because the originator is often already owning it. So they've underwritten that. But often you are getting to the full amount met, sometimes within minutes, sometimes within hours, sometimes within days or weeks.
Okay, let's use the continuing example of Sandy Koufax. You have X amount of Sandy Koufax.
Yep.
To what degree is that liquid, and who's going to be supervises the sales? What would be the exchange?
So right now, the way it works is there's a number of different originators. The examples that we're talking about with Sandy Koufax would be a collectibles originator. In the collectible space, there's a company called Otis. There's a company called Rally. There's a company called Collectible. There's others, which you can get into NFTs, which are like digital collectibles. And what will happen is often where you are originating the deal, where you're purchasing originally, is where you will be doing your secondary trading. So they will allow for the matching process between supply and demand. Let's talk about Sandy Koufax again. So often there's a lockup period where, let's say, the deal closed today. And let's say you wanted to sell tomorrow your shares. Usually that's not allowed. Usually they will lock up for 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, maybe a year to allow for things to settle in. And then the secondary trading will be allowed. So let's say, for example, let's say 90 days. So after 90 days, I will be able to enter the markets of secondary trading, and I can set my price and say, you know, I'm willing to sell my $10 shares that I bought for $20. And I can list that on a secondary market, the one often that I bought it on. Now, it's not as fluid as Robinhood, because Robinhood is massively liquid. There's so many people that are buying and so many people that are selling on both sides. And the public markets have huge infrastructure that's been built out by things called market makers and others that really make the trades happen so fast, because they're able to match what people want versus what people are trying to sell for. The bid and the ask are the terms. But in these new spaces, in these alternative markets, it's not quite as liquid yet. So sometimes you don't match immediately or within even an hour or even a day. Sometimes it might take days or weeks to find that match, or it could be instantaneous depending how the market works out. So if I'm looking for $20, but the other folks are coming in saying, you know what, you just bought this for $10 3 months ago, but I will buy for $12 right now, or I will buy for $14, but you know, I'm sticking out for $20. I'm just gonna have to wait because my match didn't come through. Now, somebody else living in, you know, for the fun of it, let's say in Alabama, they are ready to sell quicker their Sandy Koufax, and they're just looking for $13. So if they were saying, I want to sell for $13, and somebody came in saying, I want to buy up to $14, that match will happen. But because I was waiting for a $20, my match didn't happen. Does that make sense?
Yes, of course. Is it 100% transparent? Let's just assume your example, bought it at $10, want to sell it at $20. Is there an exchange so that while I'm asleep, the transaction will happen if someone bids $20?
Yes. I wouldn't use the word exchange. That's a little bit of a technical word. Usually exchange does mean a more sophisticated, quick transaction. Really what these are called are billboard secondary, because it's almost like you're posting something on, like in the old style newspapers, classifieds, where, you know, some people will say, I'm looking to sell my Sandy Koufax for $20, and somebody else is saying, I'm looking to buy Sandy Koufaxes for $14. It's almost like somebody will manually be reading the classifieds and say, oh, I think these two people should talk to each other. And that's actually just happening a little bit more fluidly on these platforms right now. It's not as sophisticated as Robinhood or as exchanges like the New York Stock Exchange or the NASDAQ, but it's way more efficient and way more fluid than the newspaper classified example I gave.
Okay, so let's say, using your example, bought at 10, want to sell at 20. I'm on the bulletin board. Can someone say, I want to buy at 20 and the transaction happen without your interaction since they met the price?
Well, yes. To be clear, the only way that me being willing to sell at 20 could be on the bulletin board is if I already confirmed and approved that. So I can't have that be on the bulletin board unless I already approved it. Once I approved it, if that other side of the transaction comes through, it will happen automatically. So you don't have to ask me again, do you really want to sell at 20? Because I already said I want to sell at 20. So no, there's not like a double confirm. You have to confirm the first time before you can even put that.
Okay, up. Let's just assume you bought it at 10. You're watching the market closely and you're emotional. You don't know what you want to sell it at. How does that work?
I mean, these are not, to be clear, these markets are not changing on these bulletin boards by the minute. Often these bulletin boards, for the sake of getting liquidity, and what I mean by liquidity, getting as many people on both sides of the market to be at the same place at the same time, they often don't do it nonstop. They'll create like almost like trading hours or a trading day where they'll say, okay, get your thoughts in. What do you want to buy at or what do you want to sell at? Here are all the things you can buy or sell. Get your thoughts in because, you know, on April, a month from now or a week from now or tomorrow is when all the trades are going to happen. And then those trades happen. And then, you know, sometimes they'll wait another week or another month before they do trading again. Now, the reason it's taking so much time as opposed to on Robinhood, things that happen within a millisecond or, you know, so many, it's because of lack of liquidity. These are smaller markets that are historically very private and they're not as large. So it's going to take time for it to become as transactional, as liquid as, you know, Robinhood and New York Stock Exchange, et cetera. But my personal opinion and why we built Vincent is I do believe by the end of this decade, by 2030, you are going to get that transparency. You are going to get that liquidity and the alternative markets are going to be very exciting. They're exciting today, but it's going to be that much closer to the infrastructure as how the public markets work.
Okay, so theoretically, I could invest $10,000.
Yep.
And a month later, I need the money for rent. I may not be able to raise that money immediately.
You might not be able to access that liquidity right immediately. That's correct. So alternative investments, one of the challenges with them historically is what makes them alternative usually is the lack of immediate liquidity. So for example, you know, if you buy real estate, you know, you try to get a nice home in Austin because Austin is really popping and you feel like being in the suburbs of Austin could be a nice investment, you know, it's hard for you to just snap your fingers and get that money out. Now, again, you know, how much demand is there for Austin real estate? Which, by the way, real estate is an asset class on Vincent, right? It's not just trading cards. You could get real estate. You know, the more liquidity, again, liquidity is people. The more people that are circling around Austin looking to buy and sell, the more likelihood that you'll be able to get in and out faster. Now, if you're trying to buy a second home in the suburbs of Anchorage, I'm guessing that you're going to have a hard time selling in the middle of winter in Anchorage, nevertheless anytime, because I'm not sure how much liquidity the suburbs of Anchorage have. So that's another example of where's the liquidity, where are the people lining up in terms of buying and selling. And alternative investments, historically, you've had to be able to, you know, be willing to tie up your money for a little bit of time, whether it's a week, a month, a year, or longer, to be able to get some of that higher return. Often with the liquidity comes a lower return. There's a premium for having your money locked up. The beauty of where alternative investments are headed is that there's all this infrastructure being built out, like exactly what we just talked about with Sandy Koufax, is over time, these things that were historically, either you buy it for $500,000 and hopefully you find the buyer to buy it for $600,000 a year later, you know, that's really hard. But now you're chopping it up into those pieces, $10 a piece. You add a lot more people that are able to trade in and out. You're starting to create more liquidity. You go from bulletin board to exchange. And now all of a sudden you're taking things that are historically super difficult and super locked up to things that can become highly liquid and quick to access your money. So that's one of the beauties of where these alternative investments are going.
Okay, let's just assume I sell. How am I charged and how much am I charged?
Again, every one of these platforms has a different model. Obviously, with Robinhood, you know, with day trading, you had Charles Schwab or E-Trade used to charge you $9 a trade. And then Robinhood told you it was free. And then we learned that free had another business model, right? So they all have their own business models. So I don't want to come across as all-knowing because they all have different business models. But typically, they're either going to charge you for the trade. Let's call it 10 bucks. They're going to charge you a percentage of the transaction. Let's call it, you know, 3%, 5%, or they'll charge you in some other fashion, whether, again, it's a subscription or they'll add a little bit of a spread without you even knowing, which is, you know, maybe the person's willing you're willing to sell your shares for 13. The person's willing to buy them for 14. All you need to know is you were willing to sell them for 13, but the fact that they charged the other person 14 and took the dollar, you don't know the better. You know what I mean? So right. all these platforms have their own business models, and it's not a single approach, which is also the opportunity for a platform like Vincent to, again, try to surface those differences, try to create that compare and contrast, because, you know, data and transparency is what's going to create more investors that trust alternatives, which is just going to create more liquidity and it's going to be better for everybody.
Okay, so let's assume I invest or I go through Vincent. There's enough information there for me to know how I will be charged when I sell.
Yeah, so we do surface as much information as we can. We're constantly improving. And I'd never want to say that our five-month-old product is perfect. So if any users on this podcast, you know, feel like there's anything that could be improved, we always want to hear it.
Okay, but also getting it straight that you could have the originator and they could supervise trade, or theoretically, it could also be the originator and other platforms simultaneously that you might be able to trade your product on.
Correct.
Okay, we were talking about the verticals. You talked about collectibles. Tell us about some of the others.
Sure. So there's real estate, like we mentioned. So, you know, real estate is one of the oldest, if not the oldest, alternative investment. The idea of, you know, you have your primary residence. That's not an alternative investment. That's your primary residence. But outside of your primary residence, there's a lot of people that say, you know what? You know, if you have some money, you should put it in real estate, because real estate is a limited asset that goes up in price over time. And instead of holding onto cash, because cash over time with inflation will devalue itself, if you put it into real estate often will stay in touch in line with inflation. So at minimum, you'll be able to get the appreciation of that in your asset. And depending on the market, you might get further appreciation because of demand for your home, for that home or for that market.
Okay, just to stay with real estate, practically, if I want to invest in real estate today, am I literally investing in one building, or does it tend to be a group of buildings?
Both. So on Vincent, you can look at specific buildings. It could be there's residential buildings, there's commercial buildings, there's commercial offices. There's all kinds of office. There's all types of building types. And that's what I would call stock picking. I mean, it's not a stock, but it's just a metaphor. It's just, you know, you're doing the picking. There's also fund products where, again, instead of you having to do all the diligence and research yourself as to whether this one specific deal is the right deal, you just know that you want to get some exposure to some real estate. You want to be able to take 10 grand or $1,000 or, you know, $250,000. And you want to be able to get that real estate exposure. There are fund products, and different platforms offer different fund products. Some platforms offer only one fund product. Some will offer several fund products, and some don't offer any. And you can choose, you could choose that as a filter on Vincent.
Okay, in this nascent market, have there been any stories of an originator either going dark without telling anybody or walking away with the asset?
The short answer is I don't think so. I think the slightly longer answer to your question, because the question you specifically asked would mean that the originator was being completely, completely negligible and negative, and, you know, trying to defraud the investor. Now, has there been some defaults where the originator genuinely tried to, you know, find an asset that would be paying, let's call it rent, or that would be able to, you know, have a nice yield of 8 or 10% or 15%. And for some reason, the underlying assumptions didn't work out because the tenants weren't able to pay or because of some defaults of something of that sort. That definitely has happened in the industry. I think it happened a little bit more during the COVID crisis, right when it all popped in, you know, March, April, May, June. But in general, the percentages of any of those types of defaults are very limited compared to the overall market.
Okay, some other verticals?
So art. Art is a vertical. So literally, you know, like I mentioned, buying a Picasso, buying a Warhol. You know, there's a cool platform called Masterworks that you could check out there. Another one is digital. So crypto and digital assets.
Okay, let's save that because that's a deeper thing. Before that, what about funds that are essentially startups? You're investing in a startup. Tell us about that.
Sure. So we call that venture. So inside of venture, there's you can invest into companies, individual companies, and get equity from these small companies. You could also invest into funds that invest into companies. And then there's other types of funds that are available. So, you know, equity crowdfunding is really kind of the origin of a lot of this. The Jobs Act got passed in 2012. I was a part of that with the Obama administration. And in 2016, it all went live. You know, you actually just saw the increase for equity crowdfunding. There was a $1 million.
Whoa. Many people are not familiar with this. Explain on a ground level, you know, what this actually means.
Yeah. So, I mean, basically, as part of the Securities Act 1933, you create the SEC. And as part of that, there's this concept of an accredited investor that was created, which means that an investor had to meet some threshold of intelligence or sophistication, which was determined by your salary or your net worth. So if you didn't have said simply about $250,000 salary or $1 million of net worth, you were considered unaccredited. And if you were unaccredited, the only way that you were allowed to participate in these investments, if they were publicly solicited, the only investments that you could publicly solicit are things that are listed on the stock market. So on the, you know, on the NASDAQ or on the New York Stock Exchange, et cetera. Things that were private listings were left for just the accredited folks. That all changed as part of the Jobs Act, saying that, you know what? These folks that don't make that much money or don't have that much net worth really should be allowed to participate, but let's limit their exposure. So what they decided was on the company side, they could only raise up to $1 million. And on the investor side, they could only invest up to $10,000. Those limits got raised a few weeks ago, actually, from $1 million to $5 million. So that what went live in 2016 got increased 5 years later to a $5 million cap, which was a huge game changer, actually. So now companies can raise up to $5 million from what I would call the crowd, the masses, from anybody, accredited or unaccredited, which is super exciting. And we have many platforms, including Republic or WeFunder or others that are originators, again, on these types of deals. And the deals that they focus on are these venture funded companies.
Okay. So if I'm not accredited, how much can I invest?
I believe it's 10 grand or up to 10% of your income, whichever is greater.
And who's checking this?
It's right now. It's a great question. Right now it's self-accreditation. So it's kind of like when you go on the websites and say that you're old enough to look at cigarette ads or, you know, cigarette companies or alcohol companies. So you have to be honest and, you know, it's self-accreditation and it's self reporting.
Okay. Now, going to the topic you mentioned, let's start on the back end. Start on the front end, the NFTs, and then get into cryptocurrency. Please explain what an NFT is.
So NFT is a non-fungible token. For those that just saw Saturday Night Live, they just try to take their hack at explaining it. So all that it means, it's a unique asset. And it's specifically been tokenized, which just means that it's been digitally stamped, that you can prove that this is what it is and without doubt. And that's all on the blockchain. Let's ignore what that means on the blockchain. It's kind of like saying it's a website on the internet. Let's just understand the blockchain is tech, whatever. And NFT is just a way of saying that this is unique and it is what it says it is. And there is no doubt about that. You know, we have similar concepts without using fancy words like NFTs. Even when we talk about like our house or our fingerprints, you know, your fingerprint is different than my fingerprint. And we could just call, it is unique and it is truly yours. And the technology that yours is on skin. So it is what it is. That's your fingerprint. If anybody wanted to prove that was you, they would have to prove that that matched the exact fingerprint of what you have. And similar for me, I have a unique fingerprint. It's uniquely me. Ours are different. And, you know, they might look similar at some level, but there is at the fundamental level, there's something that's different about it and it could be proven. So NFTs are then created. So that's a non-fungible token. And it's just, you know, applied against all these various things right now. And people are using it towards art. But you can really just think about of anything that you can prove that it is uniquely what it says it is. And usually it is scarce. That's what makes the non-fungible tokens. It can't be like replaced. If you take one piece of gold and another piece of gold and you trade them or you put them in two different hands and you mix them around, and you say which one was which, it doesn't really matter, right? Because gold is gold is gold, as long as it's the same caliber of gold.
They would be fungible.
Exactly. But if you take, you know, my fingerprint and your fingerprint or me or you, I mean, I know we look similar, but somebody says, who's who? I mean, there's only one of me and only one of you. And that's what makes it a non-fungible token.
Okay. Now, all the excitement.
Sorry. It's non-fungible and the token portion just means it's a technical jargon that it's on the blockchain and it's tokenized.
Recently, there has been a lot of ink, a lot of excitement, and also a lot of sales about tokenization of certain items which could be rapidly and endlessly reproduced in the marketplace. There are sports clips. There is digital art. So let's start from the beginning. An NFT could represent something physical and something not physical, correct?
I mean, officially, the fact that it's tokenized means that it's on a digital blockchain, but it could represent something that's physical. Yes, but it would be the digital token really is digital.
Right. So let's just say in the case of, you know, selling, let's start with a sports clip. People are buying sports clips. Tell me the thinking, your thinking about that.
I mean, I'm a fan of NBA Top Shot. That's one of the things you're referring to. I'm a buyer. I love sports. I love trading cards. I've been buying trading cards. We even talked about Sandy Koufax, you know, before, since I was a kid. So I really do see the NFT version of sports cards with these videos and these moments as kind of a V2 of sports cards. I see it as kind of the next evolution, kind of like where you see vinyl moving to CDs, CDs moving to MP3s, whatever. It's just the next evolution. At the end of the day, good music is good music. It doesn't matter what the tech is. Right. So that's just my perspective. That said, NBA Top Shot, I think, is awesome because it's just a new version of sports cards. The thing that you said that I'm not sure if you said it on purpose, I have to disagree with. You said that it could easily be replicated for these videos. They can't be replicated. The same video could be seen on YouTube, but having that specific NFT where it's uniquely identified as that is the one, just like my fingerprint, cannot be replicated. So the fact that maybe there's you know, a LeBron James dunk that's really famous, and there's a moment that NBA Top Shot created, and there's only 10 of those dunks, and you happen to get the first one of the 10, or it doesn't matter, there's one out of one, and you have it, a lot of people are going to want it because that's interesting. Now, can somebody get the same exact video of that dunk on their phone, on their computer, on YouTube, on Snapchat, on whatever? They absolutely can. Can I take a photo of Mona Lisa and show it to you? Absolutely can. All these things are possible, but the thing that is unique is the one that is uniquely stamped to say that is one of one, and we all want it, where a lot of people want it.
Okay, but we know with collectibles, whether it be baseball cards or automobiles, etc., there's a limited market, and the price can fluctuate wildly. That's on physical assets. Basically, if you buy a sports clip, if there's not a market for it of people who want to buy that clip, essentially it is worth nothing other than to make you feel good that you own it. Is that, you would say that was correct, correct?
Absolutely correct. But that was true with anything. You know, if you buy a Mazda Miata because you think it's a cute car and you hope to make $1 million, and then you find out there's no market, you know, it makes you feel good that you bought it. If you buy this moment on NBA Top Shot of you know, LeBron James, and no one wants to buy it, then, you know, the market is the market. And if everybody wants to pay you a lot of money for your silly, you know, garbage patch kid, then they all want to pay you for that, you know, and if not, they don't. I mean, that's supply and demand. And that's okay.
We had the Beanie Baby situation. Let's just go one step deeper, because what is, you know, creating all this ink is people selling digital assets for enormous prices.
Yep.
Most people would say that the people paying enormous prices are people in the crypto world who've already made a lot of money in the crypto world. Do you think that is accurate or inaccurate?
I mean, I don't have facts, but my opinion is, yes, there is a lot of money that is moving around trying to diversify their ownership beyond, you know, a certain amount of assets. You saw this in 2017-18 as well, in the rise of Bitcoin. You saw these, you know, second tier coins really start to pop because people didn't want to rely solely on Bitcoin as to where all their crypto gains were going. So you are seeing a diversification. You know, that let's call it, that wave popped and came down significantly. That's where the term shit coins came from, because a lot of these, you know, turned to shit. You know, come back to today, a lot of these coins that people thought were garbage have come back really strong. And Bitcoin, which, you know, capped out just under 20,000, fell all the way down to 3 or 4 or whatever, and now is hovering around 60. So yes, it took a few years. Yes, you had to be patient. So I mean, I think these things evolve. I think NFTs will see a similar ride. So the short answer to your question is, do I think that some amount of money that's coming into this market is because it's crypto money that's, you know, diversifying and just moving around their money? I think the short answer is yes. Do I think that's the only market? No. Do I think there's new entrants into digital because of these moments, because of these NFTs, because people are attracted to sports, people are attracted to collectibles, they're attracted to art, and it's an interesting way to enter into digital? Absolutely. I think this is just a good marketing. You know what? You know, Chilean sea bass was not always called Chilean sea bass. You know what it used to be called?
I know this story, but I can't remember what it used to be called.
Patagonian toothfish, you know. And then, like, the group that was in charge of selling Patagonian toothfish was like, hey, we're not selling any Patagonian toothfish. Let's rename it. Who wants to buy a Patagonian toothfish? Let's call it Chilean sea bass. Off the shelf, flying, flying, flying. So, you know, people called it Bitcoin. People called it, you know, shit coins. People called it protocols. People called it blockchain, all this other stuff. People were like, way nerdy for me. I don't get it. Whatever, whatever, whatever. All of a sudden, you put it under a wrapper of a sports clip, some art, some culturally relevant things. It's still on the same blockchain. You know what I mean? It's still like the same concept.
Oh, okay, but let's use Bitcoin, which is the big kahuna here. Bitcoin, you can actually, Bitcoin is fungible.
Yep.
You can buy Bitcoin and sell it. Okay. It is inherent. You can invest in it, but theoretically, it's a currency. Let's start there. What are your thoughts about digital currency? Irrelevant of whether someone invests in it and the volatility. Is digital currency the future or what?
I mean, I think that our own currency, the US dollar, is already massively digital. To be clear, I don't remember the last time I touched a paper dollar. I haven't written actual checks with paper in literally 20 years. So to me, I use my credit card. I scan my phone against those different sensors at Whole Foods. So to me, I'm already using a digital currency. It just happens to have, you know, less appreciation these days, especially in a world of the central bank being able to print money, which is being done. So I don't have control over the, you know, devaluing or valuing of the currency. So I appreciate something like Bitcoin that has a limited set that cannot be printed more of. It can be divided further, but I like it from that perspective, like I would think of gold, you know, as a, like a store of value. In terms of digital currency, I think that, you know, all, like I said, I already think the USD is highly digital. So I think that concept is a little abstract for me.
Well, let me use Mark Andreessen's thought. Okay, he talks about trade, and you get the bank in between the buyer and the seller in a foreign country. He specifically used the example of Africa. And he said there's a lot of fraud in the system that digital currency would get rid of by taking out all those middle people.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. To me, again, that's having a transparent ledger where it's very clear what is authentic and what is true and what has actually happened. And from that perspective, I love the blockchain. And that's where I think people are appreciating NFTs on the blockchain, because was this really what somebody said it was? Well, you don't have to worry about that. You know, a lot of people are selling their sneakers on eBay or on Goat or StockX. One of the biggest concerns is, are these really the sneakers people say they are? So should I be paying $100 for these sneakers or $25,000? Because if they're really what you say they are, they should be $25,000. So a lot of these marketplaces, usually one of the most valuable things they nail is trust. Airbnb, people trust it. You know, YouTube, now people trust. And I think blockchain helps to create trust.
Okay, what about all the blowback about the energy costs of blockchain?
I'm going to admit I am not sophisticated enough to understand all the details there on the energy level, but I mean, yeah, I think it's not a topic I'm great to cover.
Okay. Now, there, as you referenced earlier, there are different digital currencies. And you talked about Vincent playing in the crypto field or making that stuff available. The big kahuna, once again, is Bitcoin, but all the NFTs tend to be Ethereum. So if I am on your platform, how do I decide, or what can you tell me about investing in cryptocurrency?
Yeah, so we're going to have that as one of the six major verticals that you can click on. And again, we're not going to the pro level detail. You know, if you are 5 years into crypto, chances are Vincent is not where you're going to learn more about crypto. Chances are you're going to learn a lot more about the other five verticals because you're so knee deep in crypto. But if you're knee deep in real estate, you're probably not going to learn a ton more about real estate, but you'll get more variety, but you'll probably learn about those other places. Again, I think it's a great entry point for a lot of folks. And as it relates to crypto or NFTs, we're going to tell you what are the platforms you can enter with. You know, we'll let you know about Coinbase. We'll let you know about what the preliminary coins are. We'll tell you about what NFTs are. We'll tell you about where your options are to be able to navigate that. And we'll present you with individual options, like actual individual offerings, or we'll tell you the platforms where you can go. And as a matter of fact, digital assets and the NFTs have been one of the fastest growing assets because we actually have proprietary data that's unique literally to the world, where we're able to aggregate the interest across the verticals. So what percentage of people are interested in real estate versus what percentage of people are interested in digital assets, what percentage are interested in collectibles? No one else has that. And we're able to show those pie charts. We put that out once a month. And you know, digital assets and crypto is the fastest growing market for the last few months. You know, we're very young, so we don't have that much data yet, but it's no surprise considering since New Year's, you've really seen this NFT craze, and you know, Bitcoin stays very high. One thing you did say, just to counter, is yes, a lot of these NFTs are on Ethereum, but they're not all on Ethereum, including NBA Top Shot, which is on Flow, their own protocol. And they specifically created their own protocol, Flow, because of the challenges that they had with Ethereum when they previously came out with CryptoKitties back a couple years ago, and the congestion and all the challenges. So they developed their own protocol, and now there's more NFTs and other companies building on that protocol. I do think you're going to see more competition at the protocol level protocols trying to win the love of these NFT markets.
Okay. Now, you said there are six verticals on Vincent. Could you list those?
Yes. So there is real estate, debt, venture, art, collectibles, and crypto.
Okay. Now, you talk about the ability of the average person to get into this marketplace. You know, in the last year or so, if not longer, the hedge funds who have traditionally been in this space have not been doing well, which would augur that maybe the average person should be suspicious or reluctant, since the pros are not doing that well.
Is there a specific question?
Yes. The question would be, if you look at the landscape, the people who traditionally beat the market were hedge funds. Right now, the hedge funds are not beating the market. They are professionals. This is what they do 24/7. As an amateur with much less information at my fingertips, is this really a place where I should be? Or should I say, I should be aligned with someone much more sophisticated?
So there's a few questions there. You know, it's hard to paint massively broad strokes on hedge funds. Some hedge funds are probably doing very well. Others are doing poorly. I think COVID was the sort of black swan event that a lot of the models weren't able to plan for. You couldn't kind of, you know, check your analysis of what would this look like. So I'm going to build a fund strategy like this. So, you know, a lot of this is algorithmic trading. That again, the algorithms weren't ready for the dynamics of COVID. So I think it's hard to paint broad strokes. I think that in the more recent market for the last year or plus, it's really been a stock picker's market, meaning a little bit more active management, not passive management. Some hedge funds are set up that way. Some are more just like, you know, just set it and forget it. And in terms of, am I sophisticated enough or should I leave it to the hedge funds? To be clear, most of these hedge funds are participating in the public markets. And the alternatives are not the public markets. I do think you're going to see more and more institutional money move into the alternative markets. But because of the lack of control by the hedge funds and all these other institutional players of the alternative markets, is where there is opportunities to be able to just be smart and try to, you know, put some money where you believe it should go. And it's not one of these things where, as the GameStop investors would say, that the system is already rigged against you, where you have no chance to win because the institutions control it. I think the alternative markets are much younger. Because of that, there's much more opportunity. And to be fair, because of that, there's more risk, which is why it's a higher risk, higher reward market. You know, I don't consider it gambling, you know, at one side of the spectrum, but it's going to be more risky than, you know, investing in the Dow 30, where you get some, I don't know, some Caterpillar and some Coca-Cola.
Okay. Going to the other side of the equation, since you've also functioned on this end, let's assume I'm a startup. Certainly 20, 15 years ago, my goal was to get VC money. I'd start with maybe angel investing and VC money. Do you believe, if you're a startup, that this is going to grow, people using these platforms to raise money as opposed to VCs? And what are the advantages and disadvantages?
Absolutely. So already with the $5 million cap, so 2020 was a huge year for equity crowdfunding. I believe like double the previous year. And this year is supposed to be something like 3-4x of last year, specifically because of the $1 to $5 million increase, plus the increased demand on the entrepreneur side and the investor side. So just a few weeks ago, when the markets changed from $1 million cap to a $5 million cap for the entrepreneurs in terms of how much limit they could raise, you actually had an entrepreneur, the founder of Gumroad, was able to, on day one, right away, raise $5 million from about 8,000 investors in 12 hours. I mean, incredible. Now, to be clear, this company was not started overnight. It was already several years old, already has a significant following, already makes millions of dollars of revenue, but it's part of the creator economy. And they wanted to get their creators involved as investors. So they opened it up to their creators and to the public, and they got funded really fast. To me, equity is the ultimate loyalty. And I think you'll see more and more of that from startups as they try to navigate the early days of dilution. Some will go to VCs. There's benefits of that. You know, a single investor, sometimes the VC is massively connected. Maybe they're an operator. They have a ton of experience. They can help you with wisdom. But sometimes they're not. Sometimes they're just money. And if they're just money, what's better? The $3 million from the just money VC or the $3 million from the crowd, which comes with ambassadorship, marketing, some tweets, promotion, some love. Now, what's the counter to that? I mean, if you're going into try to solicit $1 million, $3 million, $5 million through equity crowdfunding, you have to be public about it. That's the whole premise, public, right? So you have to go out hat in hand and say, you know, public, here's my company. Here's what's going on. You got to open the kimono a little bit, talk about what your revenues are, talk about what's going well, what's not going well. And it might not turn out to be a great result. And if you get publicly turned down, that's tough. You know, that's a risk. That could be a risk to your actual business because that's marketing that didn't go well. Also, it could be challenging to have to interact with that many investors. And, you know, do you want to deal with the overhead related to the, you know, the follow-ups, et cetera, et cetera? I mean, I believe overall the pros outweigh the cons, but I do think these are decisions that people will make more regularly. And I think this will be an exciting evolution of our capital markets, especially for these early stage opportunities.
Let's switch gears completely. Tell me about the generation or the start of Indiegogo.
So basically, you're saying I'm old. So we're going to talk about another company now. So we started Indiegogo in 2006. We came up, we launched in 2008. We launched at Sundance. We started with film only. The idea back then, before the word crowdfunding existed and before any of the platforms existed, was really, you know, it was about the gatekeeper. Right? Who was the VC? Who was the banker? Who was the grant maker at the institution? Who was that person that you need to kiss their ring and hopefully get their stamp of approval? And there was that man or woman that they got to decide everything, or those five people that get to decide everything. But in a world of YouTube was starting to become interesting, why was it that you couldn't ask the crowd, you know, to fund you or not? We wanted to do what is now known as equity crowdfunding right away in 2008. The rules did not allow it because of the various regulations. And so we came out with this workaround, which is, you know, a perks or a donation-based model where you get maybe a robot in return, a music album in return, a poster in return, a t-shirt in return, or a donation, a tax deduction. And we did that and off to the races. So it's been a wild ride. In 2012, you know, we then were able to navigate the Jobs Act, as I mentioned before, and things have evolved quickly. But I'm happy to add more color wherever you think is appropriate.
Okay. So it's called Indiegogo like indie films.
It is called Indiegogo like independent is right. Where the term comes from. It wasn't specifically because of indie films. It was more the independent spirit. That was the concept. But we always knew like Amazon was going to be for everything, but started with books. We try to take a play out of Bezos' playbook, which is starting one vertical to get product market fit. So we started with film. So we tried to get better product market fit first there, and then we evolved into everything.
Okay. From a layman's viewpoint, there were two entrants in the marketplace and still two big ones today, Indiegogo and Kickstarter. From your viewpoint, who came first? Who innovated first? Because there are similarities and differences.
Well, it's not exactly from my viewpoint. We could just ask Wayback Machine the facts. We were first. That's not exactly an opinion. Kickstarter came about a little over a year later, about a year and a half. Kickstarter did lots of great things. They brought a lot of amazing design, did a lot of good curation in terms of good product projects. I thought it was great historically to be able to both compete and both improve for the backers, the funders, a product that everybody likes. And to be fair, over time, there were more entrants that came in, right? You have GoFundMe comes in and does a really great job in the cause and nonprofit space. And then Patreon comes in too. And Patreon comes in late, focused much more on the creator. You know, I think they just raised, was it today? I think at a $4 billion valuation,
right.
God bless them. So yeah, I mean, the concept of crowdfunding has really been abstracted quite a bit. But yeah, I guess, you know, when I'm old, I'll get to at least appreciate that pretty much, you know, we helped start the entire movement in January 2008.
Okay. So when you have Kickstarter, just talking about those two companies, Kickstarter and Indiegogo, are they relatively the same size? Is one larger than another?
Today?
Today.
Yeah, so they're pretty similar. I think, you know, Indiegogo focuses very much on the entrepreneur. And I would say that Kickstarter focuses more on the creator. There are certain verticals that Indiegogo doesn't focus on that Kickstarter does very well in. For example, like gaming and some other verticals. But inside the verticals that Indiegogo focuses on, we're definitely very large and doing very well.
Okay, and to what degree are you still involved?
I mean, I'm definitely involved. I'm on the board, a large shareholder, to say the least, and still very much care how my first child does. I actually have two human children now. One is 5 and a half and one is almost 3. But I know what it's like to raise them and I know what it was like to raise Indiegogo. So Indiegogo is definitely still the first child. So definitely involved. You know, we put in a great CEO, a senior executive from Reddit. Indiegogo is doing really well. We've been growing significantly. COVID was actually a major tailwind, kind of like Etsy and Amazon. You saw a lot of that demand for digital as well as kind of unique things. And we saw that demand come to Indiegogo and we're actually profitable and we've been profitable for a while.
Okay, but Kickstarter is basically going to limit, I don't want to use the wrong technology, but they're not talking about ultimately selling it, et cetera. What is the Indiegogo viewpoint?
I mean, I can't comment on what Kickstarter does. I'm not on the board there, but Indiegogo, you know, like I mentioned, we're profitable, we're sustainable, get to, you know, run our own future. And, you know, we still want to figure out where we're going to be when we grow up. As long as we have customers that like using us and we're improving the product, we'll keep on looking to serve the market. We're geriatric in internet time. We're like 13 years old.
Yeah, but you know, it's a game of musical chairs and there are fewer chairs and they're ever reducing. So theoretically, Indiegogo could go public and you could have a big payday.
Theoretically, anything is possible.
Okay. Well, in Kickstarter, I'm pretty sure they said no for them. So let's talk about you. So where did you grow up?
I was born in Belarus in Minsk, which is former Soviet Union. And then I was born in 78, came over when I was 6 months old with my parents and my brother to Brooklyn. We lived there, so I'm a Jew. So that's how.
Wait. Just because I'm interested, how did your family get out of Belarus? Because it wasn't so easy then.
Right. So we're Jewish. And, you know, Belarus and the Soviet Union wasn't too excited about keeping their Jews. So they were open to letting the Jews go. So we were part of that wave and my dad put our name into the lottery and we won the lottery. You know, winning is a relative concept to be able to leave without anything and to be an immigrant with nothing except for the clothes on your backs and come into Brooklyn, Brooklyn in 79 and then the 80s. The Giuliani 80s.
Before we get to the Giuliani 80s, what did your father do for work in Belarus? And then what did he do in Brooklyn?
Yeah, so I have really great parents, smart parents, which actually just shows how much Russia didn't care about Jews because they let go of a mechanical engineer and my mom's a doctor. So two of the two main professions that the Soviet Union wanted, which was engineers and doctors. They let go of two of those folks. So my dad became an engineer again in Brooklyn. He actually didn't know English. He learned English by watching movies. He learned German in Russia, so he didn't study English in Russia. My mother actually studied some English back in Russia. She had to retake her certification, so she was a certified doctor in Belarus, and then she had to be recertified in English, which I can't even fathom that concept. That's kind of like graduating college and then having to do it again in another language. That's bananas. While she had two kids. So we were in Brooklyn until I was seven. Then my mom got her residency. Go ahead.
No, so she did pass those boards.
She sure did.
Okay, so you're saying you were in Brooklyn until you're seven. She had a residency.
So she got her residency in Northeast Pennsylvania in Scranton-Wilkes-Barre area. So we all moved to Scranton as part of that. My dad then got cancer and when I was in high school, and he died when I was in high school. And I then went to Penn. I went to Wharton undergrad.
Well, a little bit slower. So you went to public school?
Yeah, so I went to private school. I went to Hebrew private school in Brooklyn. And then I went to Hebrew private day school in Pennsylvania through eighth grade. I was going to go to a private secular school for high school like my brother did. Because my dad died of cancer, we were, struggling more with cash and trying to make sure that things were able to work out. So we decided I would go to public school for high school.
Right. So what was it like? Cause I certainly went to high school, being the new kid in high school with the first name Slava.
It was challenging. It was challenging. I mean, one, I was the new kid. To the high school for my district was like, I don't know, 90% Italian and literally 100% Catholic. It was challenging. Slava was one thing. It was actually more challenging to be Jewish, to be perfectly frank. At least in my school, being a Jew was... I might as well have been a dinosaur, like something that they saw in the movies, like on Jurassic Park. And it was an interesting experience. Just navigated. I had to deal with some anti-Semitism, but overall, I think it was fine. I graduated valedictorian, so that had some pros and cons. Pros being like, it's nice to finish top of your class. Cons that, people kind of knew that I was smart, and it's not always the best thing to do to be like smart as part of your coolness factor in high school. I did buffer that a little bit with being an athlete. I wouldn't call myself a jock, but I did play football, basketball, and tennis. I just rolled with the punches, and sometimes that included punches, but it's all good.
Okay, so if you were the valedictorian, I grew up in a Jewish family, but a couple of generations removed from Russia, and there was a lot of parental pressure to do well in school. Did you have that same pressure?
Believe it or not, no. I find it fascinating how the results came about, but my parents were too busy surviving and being entrepreneurs themselves. And when I say the word entrepreneur, I don't mean in vocation. I mean in just navigating life. So they had so many risks and so many problems to navigate on their own to make it seem like life was okay for their kids that I don't think they had like enough capacity to like over focus on you need to get an A+. That doesn't mean they were okay with like a D- coming in on the report card, but it was kind of like, hey, you're studying, you're doing your work, I don't really remember getting helicoptered over me. I think my brother, who's 4.5 years older, probably did have more of that. And I'm the younger child. So, the more children you have, the later the child, the less, the parents care, as I smile. But, and then by the time I'm, already in high school, sorry, in late grade school and then high school, you know, my dad's already getting cancer and, you know, that's three really rough years. There's no focusing on my grades when that's happening. So, you know, I was kind of like, I just thought it was important for me to be educated to try to have a good future.
Okay. What does your brother do today?
So my brother works for Citibank.
Okay. So you have two kids. They're young. Let's say your kids said they didn't want to go to college. That'd be okay with you?
I mean, generically, that's totally fine with me. I think college as a, you know, a structure is evolving. So I don't really have an issue with that. I do have an issue with them not getting educated and being like responsible adults and of high integrity and being able to be good decision makers. I think that with information coming to our fingertips at every direction and having the simple facts or the calculus being figured out for us by computers, being able to navigate morality and ethics and decision making is really important. Whether that requires college or not, I'm not sure, but I would want them to be, you know, well-educated and ready for life as they become grownups.
Okay, so you go to Penn and you go to Wharton. So you go in knowing that you want to study business?
Yeah, I mean, I started buying and selling trading cards, going back to the early parts of our discussion, when I was a kid. I'm talking like, you know, 9, 10, 11, 12. Like I was already buying basketball cards and trying to buy them for $4 and try to sell them for $10 at the malls or at the hotels or at these like shows. And I was like a little kid and I loved getting these magazines, you know, Beckett and Tough Stuff. Beckett still exists, you know, 30 years later, but Beckett and Tough Stuff. And, you know, you can only get these magazines once a month and they would tell you the price went up or it went down once a month. And the arrow was up or down or flat once a month. Can you imagine? Now we're asking if we could get liquidity within a millisecond like Robinhood. I'm talking about once a month. So, I mean, like, yeah, I loved it back then. I went into this high school program where they asked you to create this kind of poster about yourself as part of the summer program and what you want your future to be. And as part of my future, I put in the poster. I was like, I want Wharton to be part of my future. This was already while I was in high school. And, you know, I was lucky enough to get into Wharton, which was great. But even back then, I thought I wanted to be involved with business. You know, I thought I was going to be more of a Wall Street, the movie, like a banker, Gordon Gekko type, you know, try to take some of the negative out of that. But I thought that's what I wanted to do. But then what I slowly learned is that's not actually who I want to be. I want to use the capabilities of business, the capabilities of decision making and math and, you know, how you create value to navigate, you know, trying to create, you know, positive things in the world, which, you know, turned out to be me being a strategy consultant for 8 years. So yeah, I never really became one of those like investment bankers or that type of role. I mean, I have investment bankers that are nice people and friends of mine, but I decided as part of, you know, getting what I wanted, I decided that wasn't what I wanted, if that makes sense.
Okay. So you were in Wharton. In retrospect, did you learn something or was it more you got a diploma?
Oh, Wharton was great. I mean, it was super, super difficult. I mean, I'm like fairly intelligent. There was way more intelligent people at Wharton. I mean, I brought the SAT average score down for sure. But the good and the bad about Wharton, it's no fooling around. It's not like some liberal arts school where hopefully you get an A or not. Like most of the classes are on a curve, massively competitive. You know, if the highest score is a 60 and you got a 59, then you got a great grade. If everybody's got a 98 and you got a 97, then you're effed. So like everything was competitive and you weren't competing, you know, you weren't 6'8" playing against 5'9"s. Everybody's pretty solid. So I loved it. I mean, you had to always be sharp. You're surrounded by really smart people, really creative people. I mean, my class, and I'm sure pretty much all the classes can say this, but you know, my graduating class has incredible results. I mean, founders of PayPal, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, great stuff, LinkedIn, whatever. Lots of cool stuff.
Okay, so what's the difference between going to graduate school in Wharton and being an undergraduate?
That's a great question. It's a great question, only because I'll have fun with this. See, a lot of people say they went to Wharton and they actually went to the business school, which is the graduate school, which, you know, I say this with a smile because we're on audio, which is way easier to get into than it is for the undergraduate degree. see an undergraduate degree, Wharton is the only Ivy with an undergraduate degree in business. So you can't get an undergraduate degree in business from Princeton or from Harvard or from whatever. So so if you want a quote unquote Ivy League degree, but you want a business degree, Wharton's the only game in town. So it's massively competitive to get into. I'm pretty confident there's no way I would get into it today if I applied today, because the caliber is just ridiculous. But yeah, I really enjoyed it. I thought it was a great experience. I personally love competition. I grew up with sports. My dad taught, my dad was great at sports. He taught us sports. I love the idea of winning and losing. I think losing and failure is pinnacle to being educated. So yeah, I really enjoyed all the team projects at Wharton, as well as all the competitive energy and everything surrounding it.
So what did you actually learn there other than the competition?
I mean, a majority of your degree is actually pretty similar to your neighbor, which is you're getting the accounting 101, 102, the finance 101, the writing, the this, the that, and then you specialize with, your focus areas. So I did two focus areas. I did a finance focus area. I was a double major. So finance and entrepreneurial management, which basically means I already knew I liked entrepreneurship. But most people, what's happening at Wharton is you're getting like 80% the exact same degree and then 20% personalized, which I like to joke around. Some people go their vocation, they want to be a plumber. So they go to learn how to be a plumber. We go to learn how to be a business person. I mean, they're just like spitting out business people. And I say that in the nicest way possible.
And then, so you graduate from Penn, and then you were talking about you had a different job before Indiegogo.
Yeah, I graduated 2000. I was a strategy consultant for just under 8 years.
For who, and what was that experience like?
Yeah, it was great. It was for Diamond. So now Diamond was bought by PwC. So it's a consulting firm. But I got to work at the most senior levels at huge companies as a consultant, helping companies navigate their biggest decisions about how to plan for the future. More specifically, I worked with companies like FedEx. I worked with Goldman Sachs. I worked with others that I'm not able to name, like large telecom companies. But like a really fun exercise that I was a part of in the early 2000s is we worked for a telecom company, a very large telecom company. And at the time, in the early 2000s, if the folks can remember, everybody was talking about the last mile internet. And they were saying DSL or cable. Is it DSL or cable? Which one's going to win? And everybody's trying to decide, DSL or cable. It's kind of like, beta, VHF, whatever. And they asked us, they're like, well, we need to deploy a ton of money against one of these. So can you tell us, is it, DSL or cable? And we did the analysis, and I'll just fast forward, but this is early 2000s, okay? So we don't even have the iPhone yet, okay? And we told them, we actually think wireless internet is going to be an interesting way to deliver last mile internet. They said, no, the question was DSL or cable. It's not that hard. We're paying you millions of dollars. All you have to say is A or B, and we're good. And we said, wireless internet is probably where things are headed. And they said, again, just DSL or cable, or we're not paying you your fees. And we're like, well, we think it's going to be wireless internet. And they said, how can it be wireless internet? And we said, well, some smart people were able to figure out how to take, the spectrum of the signal for your video, and now they give you internet through that cable. Well, those same smart people are going to figure out how to take the signal from your cell phones, and they're going to put internet on it. And they're like, that's going to be really too difficult. And the amazing thing is, like about 7 years later, I remember like that first commercial, I think it was like 2008, maybe 2009. There's like that commercial where there's this guy who's walking through the swamp, and he's holding his laptop above the water of the swamp. And he has like a little dongle that's connected into the laptop. And he's like using the internet with the dongle. And I was like, oh my gosh, somebody's actually doing this. Wireless internet. Here you go. I mean, obviously now, kids don't even understand what it means to not have internet on your phone wirelessly. That's just like water, right? It's more important than water. So yeah, I used to do that. So try to predict 5 to 7 years out where companies should be trying to aim their huge tankers, because it's not always easy to be nimble. So yeah, that's what I did for a while. And it was great learning, because I got to learn corporate structure. I got to manage folks. I got to see how to make big decisions. And that was really helpful to building Indiegogo. And then now Vincent.
So how did you decide to leave? And what was the first thing you did after you left?
Well, I always wanted to be entrepreneurial. I just never had the gut instinct on what to do. And then finally, my two co-founders, Eric, Danae, and I came up with the idea for Indiegogo. I then parallel processed building Indiegogo while working at Diamond for all of 2007. And then January 1st, I officially went full-time on Indiegogo. I was excited, you know. As much as being in the services industry is great, and what I mean by that, you know, being a lawyer, a banker, a consultant, etc., being able to be an operator and actually making something and bringing, you know, turning air into reality and bringing something to the world is really like so fun, just so awesome. It's also like massively difficult, but it's so great.
And when you started Indiegogo, what'd you do for money?
So we purposely planned, the two co-founders and I, to use our own savings up front. So I purposely saved. We actually got rejected by 93 VCs in a row because the market crashed at the end of 2008, in the fall of 2008. We definitely didn't predict that. So we definitely ran out of money. You know, I was paying to work for 3 years pretty much. So that was not a good paying job, bad ROI. But in the long run, it all worked out because it got me to the results I'm at today, and it's all good. I like to think long-term. Often there's short-term pain or short-term obstacles. And usually the things that are the most valuable or will get you the most return will require a little bit more of that long-term view and some challenges you need to overcome.
And in those 3 years, how many times did you say to yourself, we should pack this in, I should go back to the other world?
Just one time, very seriously. It was middle of 2009. It was already very dark. Crash of 2008 was rough. It was pretty clear we weren't going to get institutional funding. It was pretty clear that we now have run out of our savings of the three founders. And it was pretty clear that the only ones we have to rely on are the three of us. There's no hiring anybody. There's no asking anybody for some money. There's only just brute force. Do we want to not get paid and keep on working on this until it works? And I remember we had this conversation where we all said to ourselves, listen, you know, it's pretty rough. I like to joke around that I was thinner back then because I couldn't afford much food. And we just said, maybe we should get part-time jobs so we could sustain ourselves a little bit better while we work on our actual gig. And for better or worse, I was very adamant. I was like, listen, the second we step out part-time, we're done. So if we want to do part-time, we might as well just close. And the argument was like, no, we want to do part-time so we can sustain doing what we want to do. And I was adamant. I was like, listen, either we're in or we're out. And if we're out, it's cool. We're done. But if we're in, it's only full. There is no part.
And how long after that conversation did it start to turn around?
Look, we made some kind of last stand sort of moves. We made some major product moves. We opened up the entire site. There's really three things we did. But yes, a few months after that, things started to turn around. And before you know it, we saw real growth. And we didn't have the opportunity to just fool around with monetization. Like, oh, it's not necessary right now. We're just trying to grow. We were monetizing right away because we wanted money. And that was really helpful. And our corporate counsel at Indiegogo is actually the same corporate counsel that I originally hired back in 2007. And he always jokes around. He's, you know, a very senior lawyer now at a firm. And he jokes around. He's like, you know, all my other clients that were of your size in the market crash of 2008, none survived past a few years. You were the only ones. And he always asked, I still don't understand how you guys survived. And I was like, it's easy. They all ran out of money. We had no money. So we could not run out of it.
Okay, so it becomes successful. How did you decide to walk away on a day-by-day basis?
So, you know, we're continuing to build and grow. We are continuing to innovate. And then a few years ago, you know, I started about 8 years ago angel investing and have really loved it. I really love entrepreneurs. I like working with entrepreneurs, even if I don't make a dollar, just because I feel like any one entrepreneur has an opportunity to change the world. So why not stack the odds in our favor for Earth and just like get as many entrepreneurs as successful as possible? And I've really enjoyed the experience. I've had some really good results. And my friend and I from Penn said to her, you know, he's been doing a great job angel investing as well. And we just said, wouldn't it be cool if we took all of our learnings and all of our operator knowledge and our network and try to pay it forward onto like, you know, the next wave of entrepreneurs? So we decided to build a venture fund. And so we launched that in 2018. And that was part of stepping away. Also, Indiegogo was really hitting more of a steady state, add more zeros type of business. And while adding more zeros is great and amazing, and the world needs more zeros, and you know, people making more money needs more zeros, I like 0 to 1 and innovation and taking air and turning into reality. So I was just looking for a little bit of the next challenge and putting in the right leaders so that I can, you know, start this fund with my friend, Cyrus.
Okay, so you started the VC fund with how much money?
Our first fund is $30 million, 30. And it's a 2018 vintage. So we're now 17 portfolio companies in, and it's going quite well.
Okay, so if you have 17 companies, so the biggest example here is SoftBank. Their hit-to-shit ratio is bad. They have these massive failures, but they have these massive successes. For those who are unsophisticated, if you have 17 companies, realistically, how many do you have your hopes on that are going to make the whole investment worth it?
Well, I mean, different VCs have different approaches how they navigate that. There's more the spray and pray, much smaller dollar amounts, and have as a diverse portfolio as possible to really play that lottery and play those actuarial sciences around the statistics. Others, you know, have more concentrated positions where they really are trying to have more hits, as you say, but maybe each of the hits doesn't have to be as big, but you want to have a higher hit ratio. For us, we're more consolidated. I mean, only 17, which is not that many for an early stage. And because our fund is so small, 30 million, I mean, small is a relative concept. If one of these companies, if we have a decent amount of ownership, decent again is all relative. If one of these companies is worth a few billion, I mean, we could have massive returns.
Okay. So from the outside, living through this whole internet explosion, you know, the middle of the 90s, everybody gets AOL and they start playing online. Then there's high speed and ultimately internet wirelessly, as you say. But there was a new company, like every month, there was a new thing. Okay. And then ultimately, we hit a big level of consolidation that we have a handful of large companies, obviously Facebook, Google, Apple, Amazon, and Microsoft. Has you seen a concomitant decrease in the number of entrepreneurs or the number of successes?
I think the actual fact is yes. I think the number of entrepreneurs is going down. But I think that includes a lot of these small businesses entrepreneurs. I think the number of tech entrepreneurs in total is growing. And I think the number of positive results is growing. So it all depends on what lens you're looking at. I do think that, you know, when we had that new wave of internet innovation in the late 90s, it was just such a huge movement of so much technology and so much opportunity. I do think blockchain is offering directionally something like that. I don't think it's quite as big of a shift, but I do think you'll get there. I think like the late 90s, there was a lot of garbage that we don't remember today. There was a lot of companies that we probably can't even remember where they fit on the Rolodex of index cards of whatever alphabet soup. But we also got Amazon and other amazing companies. So are there going to be game-changing companies that we live with 10 years from now that are fairly young right now? Absolutely. Are all the companies that are talking about NFTs or crypto or blockchain or whatever fancy technology? I mean, we haven't even talked about DNA sequencing. We haven't even talked about, I mean, there's so many things, right? Innovation will continue. Companies will continue to improve the world, and they'll create, you know, enterprise value and wealth as part of it. That is without a doubt. What often happens is people expect the things to happen quicker than they do in the short term, and they're surprised how quickly they happen in the long term.
I understand that. Okay. In terms of consolidation, I mean, Brad Stone wrote a whole book about Amazon with diapers.com. You know, they forced them to sell, and then they ultimately go out of the diaper business. You have Facebook buying WhatsApp before people in Washington, D.C. even know what it is, and they certainly buy Instagram. As a VC and as new companies, that must be imposing. That must say, hey, we got to find our direction. Otherwise, one of these big companies will either put us out of business or force us to sell that to them.
Yeah, it's imposing for sure. But, you know, you need to live out of respect, not fear. So if you don't respect your competition, if you don't understand the landscape, don't understand the situation, then you're destined to just fail. If you live out of fear from even starting because, of course, Amazon will just crush me, or of course, Google will just crush me, then what's the point? You might as well just not start. You know, a lot of the key to succeeding is just putting one foot in front of the next and continue to make progress. And the truth of the matter is, while these huge companies are amazing and great, and I'm a shareholder of a lot of them because they're public and I've been invested in them for a while because I think a lot of them are great companies. You know, they're also big, huge companies now that are slow and not nimble. So that's why there's all these opportunities for these nimble startups that continue to crush it. You know, we're about to see Coinbase go public. I mean, what is going to be that valuation? Honestly, it's going to be absolutely obnoxious. I mean, I'm quite confident it's going to be over $100 billion. So where was Google? Where was Amazon? Where was Facebook? They could have all built it, right? And it happened right underneath their noses.
Okay, so what are the 17 companies, or what are they? What areas are they working in that you've invested in?
So we love health tech because of my partner, Cyrus, who helped build ZocDoc. We love marketplaces because, again, my experience with Indiegogo. And we love frontier tech, which is kind of cutting edge technology companies run by technologists. Now, we're generalists, so we have all kinds of different companies, but I'm happy to give you a few examples. So one is Galileo. So Galileo is from Tom Lee, who built One Medical Group. One Medical went public about a year ago. And, you know, Tom is a serial entrepreneur, massively successful. And he's really taking the best of telehealth and bringing AI to medicine and putting almost like a doctor in your pocket that you can have a subscription to telehealth for, you know, a minimal cost. And then helping to minimize costs as part of how he's sending folks to your home. So to minimize referrals or emergency room needs. Anyway, so we were lucky enough to get in super early with Tom's most recent company, Galileo, and they're doing incredible off to the races. So that's one example. Another one in that space would be like Peak, getpeaktoday.com. So they're doing direct to consumer for testosterone health. So a lot of men have low testosterone, which is an issue on many levels. So it's a chronic condition. They're able to get the blood test right in your home, have the doctor consults, and then provide the relevant medications, et cetera, all through your home, which is super interesting. Now, in terms of a marketplace, obviously, we talked about Vincent. Vincent, you know, is the alternative investments marketplace and aggregator. Another interesting company is Shadow, which is helping to end Lost, starting with Lost Dogs. They started in New York City, and now they're in many different zip codes all around the country. And they're really just taking another slice out of Craigslist, where Craigslist has been sliced and diced into incredible unicorn companies, whether it's, you know, Trulia for real estate, whether it's Match.com for dating, whether it's Airbnb. But one of those things that people still use Craigslist for is lost and found. So Shadow is helping to end that. We have an interesting direct-to-consumer company in the furniture space called Burrow. So Burrow, B-U-R-R-O-W, you know, they came out of Penn as well. We got to invest in them when they were doing under $3 million of revenue for the year. And, you know, this past year, they did way more than that, meaning like over $50 million, which is absolutely incredible. And then on the frontier tech side, you know, we have some super geeky companies, which I love. One is Madebot, which is a commercial vacuum cleaner, but where robotics meets AI. I like to call it, if Tesla built a vacuum cleaner, this would be it for commercial cleaning. So for hotels, for malls, for airports, et cetera, they definitely had a dark day when COVID started because all their customers were literally hit by COVID. But now that we're slowly getting on the other side, the demand for their product is higher than ever. And then another is Chef Robotics. So they're bringing AI and robotics to augment how food gets deployed, whether it's at a food manufacturing facility or potentially at a quick service restaurant like a Sweetgreen or a Chipotle. So really trying to augment the human interaction there to make sure you're getting exactly what you wanted, no extra germs and no extra, you know, food that you didn't want in there. So everything is super cleanly, clean and, you know, done at significant scale. So that's like a few examples.
Those are great. So let me ask you, do you ever want to get in on a deal and someone else, they go with a different company?
So do I ever lose out on an investment because somebody else gets it instead of me?
Yes.
Yes, that does happen. I would say if that didn't happen, it means I'm not trying hard enough. Luckily, it doesn't happen that often. Actually, quite the opposite is happening, which is the deals are already closed or they're about to close. And then we're getting allocation at the very end because we're bringing something very unique between Cyrus, myself, and our network of advisors. We're really bringing experience from inception of starting a company all the way to having significant enterprise value in unicorns. There's not that many people that actually have that experience from all the way from inception to significant enterprise value. There's a lot of people that have started inception to seeing some value. And there's a lot of people that have joined companies at some value and seen them become rocket ships to be worth tons of money. But to go from the very beginning all the way through is not that normal. A lot of that is isolated in Silicon Valley. It's starting to spread out more, but we built out our fund in New York and a lot of people value our, you know, operator experience. And we're very straight shooters with our New York approach. So yes, does it happen? It definitely has happened. Am I sad? Definitely sad. Do I ever like losing? I prefer not. I mean, the sports, you know, player in me, doesn't like losing, but it just means that we got to keep on refining our craft and keep getting better.
Okay. So if you invested in 17, how many did you pass on?
A lot.
Okay. We'll leave it at that. So talking about Vincent, to what degree are you personally hands-on?
Yeah, I'm very involved. I'm one of the four founders. I think you said I'm chairman, so I'm executive chairman. So I'm definitely involved every day. I actually know what it's like to run a company, you know, like I mentioned, from inception to large growth as CEO. And I knew that, you know, having somebody there with me as the day-to-day CEO, having a great COO, having a great CTO is really important to me. So I'm really excited about the team. It's a killer team with, you know, for example, our CTO was the lead engineer at Mirror that just sold to Lululemon for $500 million. So he was hand soldering the product together and pulling the software together with the team. My COO was the guy who helped build my investing business at Indiegogo. So has the perfect background to be building this business. And then my CEO is a serial entrepreneur with multiple exits. So really first class team. The whole team is four founders, two engineers, two additional engineers, and a designer. So only seven people right now, but you know, there's lots of experience and lots of scale out of that team.
Okay. Are you doing any marketing? How are people finding out about Vincent? Or do you want to keep it on the down low while you work out the kinks?
No, we're definitely marketing. We mostly just go on the Bob Lefsetz show and just try to do the podcast as often as possible. No, we're definitely doing marketing. I mean, for us, we're doing a lot of content and we're trying to educate folks. So we're putting out a newsletter that everybody should sign up at called the Pulse Newsletter. Once a week, you get the best information across the entire spectrum of alternative investing. It's usually about 10 to 20 pieces of content all in one place, which people love. We're creating our own blogs at least one every 2 days. We're doing our own clubhouses. We're creating our own proprietary reports, which we're putting out once a month. We're putting out a new one tomorrow. Obviously, I don't know when this is going to go live, but on April 8th, we will have April 8th, 2021. Who knows the archive? We'll be having a new report drop as to how March by the numbers for all the entire alternative investments market was. So yeah, we're definitely marketing and we're trying to use education and content as the number one approach for sure.
Now, if you look at similar aggregators, although the business model might not be the same, but we look at travel. We had, you know, Kayak, we have Orbitz, never mind consolidation thereafter. Do you have a competitor in this field? Do you believe that there will be competitors? Is there a first mover advantage?
There's not really any competitors that have any scale. Like I mentioned, we're only 5 months old. So I would say we're not even that relevant yet, but we're trying to become relevant quickly. We're growing quickly. The numbers are adding up fast, which is awesome. And users are enjoying their experience. But like I tell any of my entrepreneurs, when they say I have no competition or I expect no competition, if you have no competition and you expect no competition, it's because you're going after a market that's irrelevant. So for sure, we will have competition. Just like with Indiegogo, we navigated competition. And when you have competition, it means there's something to compete for. So I look forward to that. And it means that we're going after something that's awesome.
Okay, Slava, this has been great. I could talk all day to you and go into all the nooks and crannies. I have a lot more questions, but I think we'll leave it at that for now. Thanks so much for doing this.
Thanks for having me. So fun.
You bet. Till next time, this is Bob Lefsetz.